Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Radio Network. It's Nature Bats Blast on BRN.FM. This June 6, 2017 edition, episode 106 of Nature Bats Blast, comes live from Ontario, Canada, and also from the Maya Mountains, Western Belize. I'm Corey Morningstar, your new co-host, Nature Bats Last on PRN. Guy, are you there? Guy? Well, I'm not sure. Guy, are you with us? I think we have some tech troubles. Looks like Guy is on cutoff for a minute. I think I'll go ahead and read something that we received from Michael, our former co-host. Anyway, Mike sent this message to Guy shortly after last month's show aired. That's who I'm replacing, and I've got big shoes to fill. Anyway, I'm just going to read this out until we get Guy back on the line. So, message from Mike. Just wanted to give you a heads up and thank you. Is that you, Guy? No. Okay, I'll continue. I'm stepping away from the Nature Bats Last podcast. It was an incredible ride, and I'm very proud of the work we did for nearly 3 years. You are very gracious for allowing me the time and space to help folks digest abrupt climate change and its near-term consequences. I've learned a great deal from you and our guests. I think the show provides a much-needed platform for the catastrophes that we're currently experiencing and the ugly road ahead. I wish you and the show all the best and will continue to support Nature Bats Last and the work of Guy McPherson any way I can. It's ultimately your work we're supporting on the podcast, so it's your call as to if or when you want to inform our listenership of my departure. I would be happy to do it myself if you'd like. I just feel it's time for me to do some other things. It certainly doesn't mean I'm disappearing from the Nature Bats Last community. Thanks for all you've done for me personally and for those who have dared to look beyond the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. And that's from Mike. So, Mike, you will be missed. There's been lots of messages coming in. People really, really sad about your departure. And again, we will do our best to fill those big shoes that you want. So, Guy, are you back on?
I'm back. What did I miss? Did I miss the whole show? I hate it when that happens.
It's all over. You missed it. So, Guy, I just read Michael's letter that he had sent in to you.
Excellent. Thanks for filling in. You know,
yeah,
here in the so-called third world, we have connection difficulties. So thanks for bearing with me.
No worries. Guy, I wanted to ask you how the show even came about.
Yeah. The idea for the show came from the Progressive Radio Network itself. I was in the studio in Manhattan for an interview with founder Gary Null, and I was met on April 15th, 2014, by producer Richard Gale. People who follow my work probably know that date, April 15th, 2014. It was the day after Michael C. Rupert's untimely death. Richard Gale asked me if I wanted to take over as host of Rupert's show, The Lifeboat Hour. By the time I left the studio a few hours later, the offer was withdrawn, and Carolyn Baker, frequent guest host of The Lifeboat Hour, became its host. However, the seed was planted. So upon my return to the Mud Hut a few days later, I asked Mike if he wanted to co-host the show on the Progressive Radio Network. Talked about it for a few days, decided we'd offer the show as part of our continuing commitment to public service, and also within the spirit of Aristotle's definition of friendship, which is what we were trying to pursue at the time.
Okay. Actually, I have a question for you. I wanted to put this at you and see that. Aristotle was Plato's student in ancient Greece. Plato was famously as free their kind.
Yeah, we're doing fine.
Okay. So Plato, of course, was famously known as the student of Socrates. Could you remind us of how Aristotle viewed friendship?
Yeah, Aristotle recognized friendship as something more significant than drinking buddies. Presumably reflecting the sentiments of his time, Aristotle defined friendship as a relationship between people working together for the common good. The key points here, especially with respect to us and our work, are one, working together, and two, the pursuit of the common good. Nature Bites Last on the Progressive Radio Network was born among friends radically pursuing and promoting evidence as one attribute or one component of the common good. Corey, you and I have never met in person. Same for Serena, who's calling in today from Western Australia. None of us have met in person, yet, Corey, you and I are long-term friends in the spirit of Aristotle. And Serena and we are friends quite recently in the spirit of Aristotle. NBL on PRN will continue its pursuit of the common good based on our commitment to evidence and the work of those who contribute to and support the show. You, Corey, in fact, have been a longtime contributor and supporter of this show. I first interviewed you on September 30th, 2014, for our 8th episode. The issue is I have no idea what took us so long to have you on the show. 8 episodes? What were we thinking?
Well, thank you, Guy, and I'm really, really humbled to be here with you. I'm really honored to have asked to be your co-host on the show. I love the show, and I know it's a very important show to a lot of people. So again, thank you so much for considering me and welcoming me to Nature Got Class. I guess, I don't know, right now I continue on working on a new, really extensive, updated piece on the blog. As you know, maybe some person will be right extensively on the nonprofit industrial complex. I've recently been really elated and very, very proud of my sister comrade Vanessa Beely, who's picked up on White Helmet, a creation of purpose, which purpose is a for-profit organization of the laws. And she's taken some information I wrote about back in 2014 on the White Helmet, and she just ran with it and fully exposed on White Helmet in her book as a terrorist organization funded by the British News Network. Yeah. So that is amazing work, Vanessa and others, Eva Bartlett, others out here doing that hard, hard work, that hard truth. Those hard truths that no one, you know, a lot of people don't actually want to know about. Yeah, and so maybe Guy in the future, once I get this Abaz series done, we can discuss that on the upcoming show. It's there's a lot about their past. Basically, it's an organization that was created way, way back to help the NATO states, especially the United States, to aid them in occupation and destabilization of sovereign states, resource-rich sovereign states around the globe. So anyway, that's upcoming. Just for our listeners out there, as always, we are taking your calls. So please dial us up toll free at 888-874-4888. And I'm going to say that number once more because we would love to hear from you. I'm taking your comments, questions. Again, 888-874-4888. We're joined today by our Australian correspondent, Serena Raphael. Serena? Are you there?
Hi. Yes, hi. I'm here. Good morning.
Am I saying your last name right, Raphael?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. Serena's going to infuse her millennial perspective into today's episode, beginning with her latest thoughts. Serena, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so Kaya, Gori, and Guy, good morning, friends from WA, Australia. So I wanted to continue the vibe of Aristotle, and can I just say what a privilege it is to be here with both of you, two of the most incredible radical mentors. It's wonderful to be here, to share this morning with such an amazing community. It's an honour, and it's just fantastic to be included. So I've been thinking lately about Aristotle's quote, the inspiration for Nature Bats Last, as well as the radical community here with us today. So friendship, individuals coming together, working towards common good. I felt motivated to write about what friendship meant to me and as a family. I went outside and I sat next to the river, and as I watched, a family of ducks floated down along the water surface, aided by the river's current, supported by the atmosphere, and I began to think about friendships differently. Perhaps Aristotle pondered this question as he noticed the friendship between honeybees and flowers, how they work cohesively, lovingly for the common good, partners within nature that assist and nourish each other. Our bodies are made up of billions of living cells and bacteria. We are a large, warm-blooded, multi-community. Our planetary friendships, the family solar system as they dance around each other. Where would the Earth be without the sun and the moon's presence? The natural world, a beautiful collage of families and friendships, together supporting life and wellness for the common good. Dominant culture is an abusive partner. With any abusive partner, they isolate you away from community, place the burden on your shoulders. Our conversations with fellow species were silenced long ago, using violence, intimidation, exploitation to gain more control. They must go faster. I'd like to include a quote from a thoughtful spider and her friend Wilbur. "Why did you do this for me?" he asked. "I don't deserve it, and I've never done anything for you." You've been my friend," replied Charlotte, "and that in itself is a tremendous thing." With Professor's philosophy in mind, we can embrace the diversity of friendships wisely, understanding the deep power of love. It has no class divide, no totalitarianism, no dictatorship, no segregation, no fear, and no shame. As I face extinction, I'll be here to support my brothers and my sister species, my loved ones, the planet's family. Culture does not control love. Friendship was here when our stories began, and they will be here at the end. As community, as friends, as an ecosystem, as a family, we shall strive to be compassionate, honourable, virtuous, because that in itself is tremendous. So that's what I've been thinking about, and that's sort of what Aristotle's definition of friendship got me thinking about. It got me thinking about how friendships really are everything, you know. So that's sort of what I've been thinking about.
Thank you.
Sorry to interrupt, Guy. That was just fucking beautiful, Serena. I'm just going to say that, okay? I have a question.
Yeah.
And I'm going to hand it over to Guy. You say culture does not control love.
No.
Do you think that culture can influence love?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
An insane culture.
Yes. The cognitive map. Absolutely. I think, it can definitely influence. I think there are certain people like us and people who are listening that have the ability to think critically about what they are told, but for the majority of people who haven't necessarily lifted the veil on what they are told, I think that love can be influenced and can be manipulated by a system, a culture like this, because you're taught that from a young age and they tell you what they want you to think.
Thank you so much. Guy, what's going on with the climate? Any stories to tell us?
Well, you know, I used to provide an update about abrupt climate change every episode, and before too long it began to dominate the show. Most people now are aware that our time is limited, but I just want to point out an occasional little tidbit here and there. For starters, there's three terms created within the last year or so indicative of abrupt climate change. These terms did not exist in the English lexicon until within the last year, and even less for a couple of them. Those terms are rain bombs. Now they're everywhere. Now the media are talking about rain bombs, these rain showers that show up and just bomb down the rain. Of course, coming from the United States media, so there has to be a militaristic thread or imprint on every single new word, thus the term rain bombs. There's also smoke waves of smoke that come out ahead of wildfires as wildfires create their own weather. And thunderstorm asthma, which we never heard a thing about until quite recently. And now every third person I know has thunderstorm asthma. One little tiny update from the abrupt climate change front. I suspect most people know about the poor design of the world's renowned seed vault near Svalbard, Norway. This has been in the news within the last couple of weeks. As any civil engineer knows, there are only three critical factors in the design of roads and other structures. Those three factors are drainage, drainage, and drainage. The seed vault, with nearly a million packages of seeds, was opened in 2008 to provide humanity with a backup plan for food. It failed all three critical design features last month when melting permafrost caused a flood in the entryway. The seeds were not damaged, but employing the word fail-safe for the seed vault brings to mind either the built-in obsolescence of Keynesian economics or the trifecta of doom, human hubris, ignorance, and stupidity. Of course, invoking an opportunity to make money by repeatedly fixing the impenetrable seed vault is disgusting. But maybe it's small wonder we're headed for human extinction in the very near term. So I guess we shouldn't be terribly surprised that the fail-safe failed, that the multi-million dollar seed vault didn't pan out as planned. And who would have planned the thing in a place that was bound to fail anyway? It's less than a couple of hundred meters above sea level. It's going to be wracked by horrible storms. And the plan for drainage was absolutely ridiculous. And it's already failing. And we're in the early stages of abrupt climate change. Furthermore, it doesn't really matter how many seeds you have if you don't have a viable climate for growing plants to eat anyway. So any comments on that from Corey and Serena are more than welcome. And again, we're taking your toll-free calls at 888-874-4888. So ring us up and start making fun of us or join the conversation. It's all the same thing, pretty much.
Wow. Well, Guy, are you telling us that we can't eat wind turbines and solar panels?
Apparently, and sadly enough, that's the case. We can't eat seed packages. We can't even eat seeds. I think the money would have been better spent putting canned peaches in the seed vaults to the seeds.
Wow, what could go wrong?
Exactly. I do have a poem here, if you don't mind us taking a little time for some poetry.
I love poetry.
Yeah, absolutely.
This comes from a self-proclaimed ancient Irishman. I would never call him that myself. He's from Dublin, and he offered a poem a few months back. It was when I was on tour in New Zealand, so it would have been from November or December. He said, "You can use my name if you want. It's Tom Barrett. I'm from Dublin. I'm a retired software writer, now interested in languages, mathematics, and most of all, the environment." And he says it was 8 second year. The poem is called "And Then There Were None." And it goes like this. 7 billion earthlings, many in a fix. The greed of few killed multitudes. And then there were six. 6 billion earthlings killing all alive. They ran out of wildlife. Then there were five. 5 billion earthlings diseased to the fore. The pills culture failed them. And then there were four. 4 billion earthlings just like you and me. The planet now begins to boil. And then there were three. 3 billion earthlings surrounded now by poo. The oceans washed the stuff ashore. And then there were two. 2 billion earthlings, the earth is nearly done. The trees are gone. No crops can grow. And then there was one. 1 billion earthlings, the planet is now done. They all went and killed themselves. And then there were none. That's a wonderful, wonderful poetic commentary on the fix we're in from Tom Barrett in Dublin, Ireland, under the title, "And Then There Were None." Thanks for that. We do have a caller, Benji. Benji, is that the Benji we know from California calling for us?
Yeah, it is. You know,
hey, Benji, what do you got to say? Speaking of poetry, do you have one for us?
Yeah, you know, I'm working real hard to create a way to accept our fate. Pursuing that shit probably won't help a bit, but it's something to do while we wait.
That's Benjamin the Donkey calling in from the San Francisco Bay Area, if I'm not mistaken.
Indeed.
Now, people at home, callers, do not read that poem that guy just wrote to your children for bedtime. Not a great name. And I was talking, you know, Bruce Palmer, obviously, right? Been on your show before, Horace. He was saying today, I just briefly chatted with him. He said the liberal left is going crazy for the whole Trump thing, pulling out his Paris Agreement. So I wondered, I wanted to get some commentary from both Guy on that, as well as Serena, because I think there's some huge things happening for Serena.
Yeah, there is. So I can jump in. Am I allowed to read something from the Queensland Government the Department of State Development?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So yesterday here, they green-lighted a project in the Galilee Basin. It's going to be the largest coal mine in Australia, and it was green-lighted yesterday. It's the Carmichael Coal Mine Rail Project, and I'm reading, this is from the Queensland Government Department of State Development, and it's determined, it's an open-cut underground coal mine with a yield of 60 million tonnes per annum and a 189-kilometre railway. It's in the Galilee Basin, 160 kilometres northwest of Claremont. It's the railway has been a massive issue here because $1 billion of taxpayer money is going towards funding the largest coal mine. It is on the Great Barrier Reef. I haven't seen anything in the green wash realm addressing this. It's all been about the Paris Agreement. I mean, this is huge. This is a massive deal. It's six open cut pits and five underground mines, five mine infrastructure areas. There's a heavy industrial area. The government have given away water, the water license to Adani. From what I understand, it's free, unlimited access to the ancient aquifers under the ground. The investment is $16.5 billion. They talk about jobs, but it's as always, it's massively overestimated to compensate for the destruction. And this is from ABC. Adani's coal mine greenlight raises more questions than answers, and they talk about where the money's coming from. Adani have announced it's giving the green light to the Carmichael mine in Queensland's Galilee Basin, and it's huge. This is the world's biggest export coal venture and the biggest mining site in Australia. Was the project's promised? It's a huge scale, depending on your viewpoint. 5 underground pits, 2 massive open-cut mines, exporting 60 million tonnes of coal per year. That's huge.
Was there a lot of opposition? I mean, there must have been.
Yes, there was. It was taken to federal court. It's been fought by the Indigenous custodians of the land. They did, from what I understand, they had a Native Title Act, which was given to them, which gave them the rights to the land. Since the interest in building this mine, that's been it's been overwritten and taken away, and they've been fighting it in court. And as always, dominant culture wins, regardless of what green groups say and what governments say about giving Indigenous rights back to the people. It's not true. If there's money in it and there's bucks to be made, that just goes out the window. So there have been huge oppositions. There have been, blah, blah, protests, sign petitions online, whatever. It doesn't matter. They have gone ahead and green-lighted the project, which it was bad. That was going to happen.
Wow. So, Serena, over where you are in Australia, are you seeing mainstream media and actually the media also funded by this? Are you seeing more about the United States pulling out of the agreement, or are you just making headlines so far?
Yeah, so the Paris Agreement. This is a huge deal, and the Paris Agreement. It was never gonna do. I mean, it was an 2 degrees. I mean, the whole thing is a charade. It's ridiculous. I mean, this coal mine is fucking huge. It's massive, and the area that it's going to cut into is pristine wilderness, and I mean this is real land, and the Great Barrier Reef, I mean it's almost two-thirds bleached now, a mass bleaching event almost every consecutive year now. It's unbelievable.
So what do you think about this? Like, what is it, and Guy, maybe you want to interject here as well, why is it that something this huge that's happening today, right now, is not getting the attention it deserves? Like, why is this Paris
It's almost as if it's all about the money. Or
yeah.
Wait, that's all about the money, isn't it? It's always been all about the money. Corey pointed out to me years ago that the scientific target was no more than 1 degree Celsius. This was pointed out by the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October of 1990. And somewhere along the line, the United Nations changed its tune when it became obvious that 1 degree was no longer possible, and they started promoting the idea of 2 degrees Celsius as the target instead. But that's a political target. That's the United Nations just adopting a target presented by an economist. I suspect that 2 degrees was conservatively viewed as the point at which civilization would fail because of the inability to grow grains. I suspect that's what's going on, but I'm not certain of that. In any event, it's been clear for years that the scientific target was 1 degree, no more than 1 degree C. And it's pretty obvious that by the time we hit 1 degree C, we'd also already triggered many self-reinforcing feedback loops. So those days of 1 degree and now 2 degrees as political target are in the rearview mirror already. You know, when you run over a dog in the road, it's a terrible thing. But sometimes you don't know you ran over the dog until you look in the rearview mirror. You hear that thump, thump. And then you look in the rearview mirror and you go, oh, no, that was a puppy. Well, that's where we're at. We not only ran over the puppy, the poor puppy, we ran over ourselves. We ran over the entire human race. We're looking in the rearview mirror, and it's too late to back up, too late to pull over, too late to get the dog back. It's already done.
Yeah.
It's behind us. And it's horrible.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's maddening besides.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So this, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear to people, especially people who work outside or spend a large amount of time outdoors, it's becoming increasingly clear that there's no stopping this, that we are in the midst of abrupt climate change, that the terms abrupt and irreversible actually don't refer to gradual and we can turn this sucker around. So, it's becoming obvious to people who are paying attention that we ran over the puppy quite a long time ago and that there is, at this point, nothing we can do except try to make the pain not so great as it otherwise might be. But there's no getting the dog back. That's game over. Extinction and death, or I should say death of individuals and extinction of species, those are irreversible. Those are forever. Those are one-time propositions. You get one shot at this whole thing, and each species gets one shot at this whole thing, and it looks like we blew our shot at it.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks, Guy. I just wanted to interject, too. I just had to move communications there. I was breaking up. The whole thing that Serena's talking about, I mean, these are really critical issues, the coal, the indigenous rights, all of this being overshadowed and actually made invisible, which the nonprofit industrial complex, the green groups, do over and over and over again. I mean,
yeah.
It's complete, you know, bread and circuses and distraction, you know, and people need to understand what these groups are set up for in this whole, this whole thing works like a well-oiled machine. And so what you get are tens of thousands of employees that work for these nonprofits and green groups all sharing the same social media and the same messages, creating huge contagions, you know, that dominate and take over and frame the whole everyone's way of thinking. And so it's really, really, genius. I mean, the social media today especially has been such a massive instrument to the elites to control the whole discussion and whole dialogue and highlight what they wish to highlight. And in this case, it's, you know, demonizing, an asshole who we already know is an asshole, demonizing an asshole.
Yeah.
And trying to make now that it works actually to make the Paris Agreement look legitimate, which it isn't.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Why are we wasting our time on this? You know, when we have real things happening on the ground, like you so articulated, Serena, in Australia, which are being completely overshadowed and completely ignored.
Yeah.
You know, Corey,
well, I mean, I've asked, people from the community, you know, do you know about the Carmichael mine? And no one knows about. Some people don't even know where the Galilee Basin is or Queensland. And so I'm like, wow, this is like the biggest coal mine in Australia, that and the biggest that is going to be in, the biggest mining venture on the planet, and no one knows about it because Trump is so much more fashionable to hate, and the Paris Agreement was so much it was much more glossy and it was nicer, and it fit the dream of being this green economy.
Yeah, you know,
but this doesn't fit that comfy image of what we want, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Are you aware of the writing of Michael Activist? I don't think he's been on Nature Bats Last yet, but we should have him on. Michael Swift out of Australia?
I may have heard of him. I may have.
I'm quite certain he's written about this campaign that you're talking about, opposition to this project, about the project,
yeah,
and about, you know, how difficult it is as well, grassroots working up against the big greens, you know, the dominant NGOs that are all funded by the same powers, power structures that benefit from, you know, the growing economy and all these different projects that we're speaking of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can definitely see that the economy means more to the Australian government because the Great Barrier Reef, I mean, it's huge. It's a beautiful part of the oceans, and it's an icon to people here, and they're choosing the export of coal over it clearly with the actions that they're taking. So it's just more evidence that the dominant culture will do anything to continue moving forward, to continue to go faster, because they're choosing the export of coal over the Great Barrier Reef. It's just evident that the dominant culture is...
And Serena, do you think that drives extinction tourism? Like when people now want to go there because they'll be the last generation that ever witnesses the reef?
Yes.
Seriously.
I've heard that. You better see it now before it's not there anymore. Yeah, but... I think it's a bit too late for that. It's from what the last time I went there was 2011, mm-hmm. And that was just after Cyclone Yasi came through, and it wasn't doing too well then. So people may have missed the chance a long time
right,
ago.
Right. Huh, another thing too that I find amazing, you know, is you have especially a huge outcry against the pulling out of the agreement. I've seen demonstrations, Paris is burning, demonstrations, you know, like Forrest said, the left is just going crazy over this. And yet I don't see any dialogue on how, I mean, what fuels the expansion of coal consumption. I see no discussion on how we're going to live with you know, only the basic necessities. I don't see any discussion of people wanting to do with less. I mean, all the green energy that's proposed and promised, the illusion of green energy, is for a handful of the few that already have access to energy. And so the whole thing, I mean, the U.S., the Democrats, you know, specifically the left that supported war criminal Barack Obama, it's the Americans that I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Guy or Serena, if you know, I believe Americans represent 5% of the global population, and yet are responsible for approximately 35% of all the consumer goods produced, if it's not higher. I mean, if you look at what's produced for the United States and China, it's an even higher number. So to, you know, cry crocodile tears over the Paris Agreement as we consume ourselves and our planet to death, I mean, just
absolutely
seems... Yeah,
I was pointing this out in my classes 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I was using the rule of 5/25. Mm-hmm. People in the United States comprise 4.5% of the world population. They still do, pretty close to that, 4.5%. So let's round up to 5. And they consume 25% of pretty much everything, or produce 25% of everything bad. So the United States produces about 25% of the greenhouse gases annually that the world produces. The United States produces about a quarter of the pollution, about a quarter of the garbage about a quarter of the, you name it, everything bad, and consumes, as you indicated, 25%, or in this case, 35% of the cheap plastic crap made in China. So that's one of the advantages, if you want to call it that, associated with having the world's reserve currency, is that you get to manipulate the currency, which is now a petrodollar, tied to petroleum, not to gold. Since the early 1970s, the Nixon administration took the United States dollar off the gold standard. And now the focus is overwhelmingly on money, 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 consumption, 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 and costs be damned. Every cost. We're willing, apparently, to pay every cost to take the road down over, to take the cliff, really, over Armageddon so that Americans can have access to cheap plastic crap and smartphones.
Right. I mean, how many people that are, you know, screaming their opposition and anger for the Trump administration pulling out of Paris, how many of them used leaf blowers on the weekend, you know, and mowed their grass and went to the mall and bought stuff they didn't need and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you could just go on and on and on, right? And so it's so much easier, you know, to point the finger at something else rather than, you know, collectively, you know, look at a reflection in the mirrors and try to really figure out how do we, you know, try to dismantle the system? How do we try to remove ourselves from this way of living? You know, it's just crazy. And so what's the, Serena, what is going on? What's the reaction from the indigenous tribes in Australia, the indigenous groups?
Well, as this, so this was green-lighted yesterday, so it was only green-lighted 24 hours ago. So okay. From what I know, that there's going to be extreme opposition. I read from a few articles that they're going to try and take this to court again. So you're going to try and use the corrupt legal system to fight this. But, you know, like what you were just saying about Trump, and that it's fashionable here to also hate Trump. It was all over the news here that he pulled out of the Paris Agreement, but look how great Australia is for not pulling out. But right, yet right. They're doing the Carmichael mine. I mean, none of it makes any fucking sense.
Right.
I just, and it's like a, you know.
Yeah, I get that. I saw Jeffrey St. Clair Counterpunch. He posted something saying, you know, how pretty boy, Christ, I can't even remember his name, Trudeau, is, you know, expressing his disappointment at the U.S. No. pulling out of the agreement when we're tearing up, you know, continue to expand the tar sands and every other form of fossil fuel production in Canada. So there's a lot of hypocrisy on every realm, every level. It's just, you know, again, I think it's all framed and designed, make us feel good, make us feel like we're the, you know, we're the good guys, and
yeah.
then we can point fingers
yeah.
at the others. In Canada, we have coming up for Canada 150, which is a huge, great big event, and the government's put in, it's a celebration. I put it in quotes, Canada 150, because it's such a slap in the face to Indigenous peoples. I mean, considering
yeah.
we're all on stolen land, and it's to celebrate
yeah.
basically the colonization and theft of Canada. Of course, so you see now it's a whole another wave of consumption of flags and T-shirts and, you know, all the plastic
yeah.
crap that comes along with it. And there's, I think, $500 million was committed to the celebration. And to this day, I mean, there's reserves all over Canada. Indigenous people still to this day do not have clean drinking water. I mean, there's water boil advisories, at least 200 a year. I mean, it's disgusting, you know. So
yeah.
again, we love the we love to feel good and pretend, just sweep everything under the rug and not acknowledge, you know, what we've done, not acknowledge what we've
yeah.
done or what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I was interviewed by Press TV via radio a few days ago, and you can find that interview near the top of the blog. with my comments about the outlash with respect to Trump and the Paris Agreement. And I point out that it's all a show, that the whole thing is a show intended to distract people. And there's nothing to be gained by the Paris Agreement, and it doesn't really matter what Trump does. Trump is going to be the biggest fall guy in history, in my opinion. We do have a caller, Bill. Bill from Indianapolis. Are you still with us?
Yeah, I have a question about a very specific prediction that you made recently, and that is that we'll have an ice-free summer based on, I think you said, daily trend lines in the first week in July, or weekly trend lines the first week in August. And that's kind of a shocking prediction. And you said that it was with like a high degree, 95% certainty you felt that it would be that way. So I kind of, my question is how did you get the information to get to that point? Where is it that you found that information? Because it definitely piqued my curiosity, you know?
Yes. Yes, it is one of those things that gets your attention, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a guy named Torstein Vidal, and pardon me, Torstein Vidal, if I'm incorrectly pronouncing your name. And he has done the trend analysis based on the latest data about sea ice. So he's the one who put together the trend lines based on the recent averages for daily and for weekly. The Arctic ice information is put out on a daily basis. And all he did was project forward based on the most recent weeks and less conservatively based on the most recent days. Now, of course, there are problems with forecasting based on the most recent days, especially if you only have a few days to forecast with, and the Arctic ice has been in free fall during those few days. So I'm crediting Torstein Vidal with that analysis, which I think is spot on. I can't imagine that we will have Arctic ice on the Arctic Ocean by September. And the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College did an analysis in 2013, and they predicted ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. Well, I'd say we dodged four bullets already, 2013, 14, 15, and 16. And now we're about to see that they weren't far off with their prediction of 2016, plus or minus 3 years. Of course, we can't continue to go down the path we're going down and not expect there to be some adverse consequences. And it looks like the bill has come due. Thanks very much for the question, Bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
That's so interesting, Guy. I was just talking to Forrest yesterday asking about the Arctic sea ice because 2017 was such a key date. I mean, back in the early, you know, even back, I remember 2007, 2017 was such a key date for the summer Arctic sea ice disappearing. Like, what will happen when that albedo is finally gone? I mean, how quickly can we expect things to heat up at that point?
Well, there's at least two contributing factors to global average temperature rise when the Arctic is ice-free. First and most obviously, there will be much less albedo, much less reflectance. When the white ice is gone and is no longer reflecting incoming solar radiation, incoming sunlight, then what we're going to be left with in that dark blue ocean is a whole lot of heat absorption. And Peter Wilde predicted in 2012, 5 years ago, Peter Wadhams pointed out that we can expect the energy absorption at the level of the planet to go from 0.75 watts per square meter to more than 2 watts per square meter in the presence of an ice-free Arctic. Already from the early 1970s until about 1990, when the energy absorption of the planet was about 0.43 watts per square meter, we went from 0.43 to 0.75 from the 20-year period of the early 70s through the early 90s compared to the period from 1991 on. So that's a profound increase in energy absorption by the planet, and that's with ice still present. And so Wadhams is, I think, reasonably and perhaps conservatively pointing out that when the ice is gone, we're going to be absorbing more than twice as much energy as we have been so far over the course of the last 20 years or so. So that's
things
huge.
Things will really, really accelerate quickly at that point.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. It's a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. And then, to make matters worse, there's a second factor, which is methane release. And if there's no ice cover over the Arctic Ocean, I can't even imagine how quickly the oceans of the world are going to heat up and the terrestrial planet will heat up as a result of methane release.
And did you see that?
There's no long lag with heating associated with methane as there is with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is about a 10-year lag between emission of the CO2 particle and maximum heating associated with that CO2 particle.
Yeah.
So there's no such lag with methane. It's right now. It's today. And it takes less than a year for the methane to circulate the entire globe.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Did you see the new report that just came out in the past day or two, basically about the methane hydrates that are found bubbling outside of the permafrost zones?
Yes, absolutely. And that's an important point. We might want to hit that again. What Corey said was outside the permafrost zone.
Yeah.
Not within the permafrost, but beyond what we consider permafrost. There's now these methane volcanoes going off.
Which makes the whole idea of the whole, throwing out the Paris Agreement just so much more ridiculous, Stevens, than, to even be discussing. I mean, it's just so beyond meaning. You know, it just has zero meaning at all at this point in time. You know, it's insane.
Yeah.
Guy, I'm going to need you to tell me when to start wrapping up just because I don't have access now to my computer. I'm on the phone.
Oh, right.
Like,
you're in
yeah,
the next
my communication
room.
Got nicked, so just let me know.
I'm glad we can hear you now. So that's a small price to pay. So, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I will let you know when we're close to that point.
And another thing, too, let me know. I hope that we can have maybe on the next episode Clive Spash. And I think he's Australian. Serena, have you heard of Clive?
No, I haven't. So I'm keen to talk to him.
Like he's actually an economist, but he's the most radical economist I think I've ever encountered in my lifetime. And he's very, very much exposing the whole point, and this just goes to show you what a moron Trump is. I mean, the whole point of the Paris Agreement is the financialization of, first and foremost, the financialization of nature, which will be like a huge, huge new market for a global economy that's close to stall speed under the capitalist system. And so he's been working on this almost exclusively. I mean, I could name not even 10 people on the planet that are constantly working to tell people what's happening today behind closed doors, and that's the payments for ecosystem services assigned to everything in the world that provides life to humans and anything that provides a service in nature. I mean, we're talking a monetary price assigned to everything that you can think of. And so, again, like a whole new market, that's what the Paris Agreement is for, first and foremost, and that's being done under the United Nations global, quote-unquote global goals, the sustainable development goals. And so it just goes to show you, how that whole administration really has no clue. They're not even really in sync with the power structures and the elites that have designed all this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because one of the biggest worries for the Australian government with the death of the Great Barrier Reef wasn't the welfare or the disappearance of the reef. It was the impact that the death of the reef would have on the local economy and the tourist economy the death of the reef would have. Like, that is psychopathic.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a pathology. I mean, the whole insane culture, you know, is just absolute madness. Yesterday, when you were talking about your beautiful, very articulate, I don't want to call it a speech, your writing, what you spoke of, I mean, it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I find gardening and being outside so vital to my sanity and existence altogether. And I even noticed on the weekend, my boyfriend actually noticed the property, and they had all these rocks and cages. And he said, oh, my God, they're even caging up the rocks now. You know, like, humans need to cage. We need to contain and dominate nature in every form. And he said, I mean, not that the rocks moved around a lot, but they got around a little bit, and now even they're being put in cages.
That's an excellent stopping point right there. Corey, why don't you take us on home from that point? That's
all
a
right,
wonderful
all right.
Comment.
Well, that's a great stopping point. I guess you're right, Guy, for today's show. thank you so much, Serena, for joining us, too. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Also, feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please share widely the link and information from the show. Also, continue to follow the Nature Bats Last blog. That's GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We will see you on the radio the first Tuesday afternoon of each month at 3 p.m. Eastern. That means our next show will broadcast live on Tuesday afternoon, the 4th of July. If you miss us live, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm or at Stitcher and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners and Afrozen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very fucking clever. But in the end,
nature
bats last.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Mother Nature. Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you.